It's really fun to be here today with Sam Tiedemann, who is the host of Transfigured, which is a podcast and YouTube channel that's looking at the logos, the deeper meaning of the logos, and looking at science. And so we have gotten together today to look at this really terrific interview that we saw on Peter Robinson's Uncommon Knowledge with David Berlinski, Stephen Meyer, and James Orr. So, Sam, does your, yes, okay. My screen has changed a little bit, so I can't find everything where it was before. We are recording, I believe. Yes, okay. They've rearranged the toolbar on Zoom. I don't know why they would do that without telling people, but there it is. So, Sam, good to have you here. What did you think of that interview?
It was very interesting. It went through a lot of different subjects very quickly, all of whom could have been their own conversation or video. It was sort of like a machine gun of various important topics. So that's why it makes it a good video to want to try and dig deeper into, because I think that there was a lot left on the table on each of those subjects.
Yeah, there were so many times I just felt like, okay, Peter, let him finish what he's saying instead of jumping to the next guy. I mean, I know he's trying to manage three people in a 1 hour conversation. So it made me feel a little bit like Jordan Peterson's interview yesterday with Elon Musk, where Elon would just start saying something that I wanted to hear the end of, and then it would pop back to Jordan. And it's like, oh my goodness. So there's a lot of good, deep stuff in here. And Sam, you had a particular thing you wanted to talk about first. So let's do that one at the outset and then see where we go from there.
Sure. Can you see my screen?
Not yet.
Huh. That's weird. I'm getting some notification that I need to allow a change of privacy setting somewhere. I'm doing my best to do that, but I'm not quite sure where this alleged screen setting privacy thing is.
Yeah, they changed the whole setup. I gave you share screen.
Yeah, it's inside Zoom somewhere. I'm telling it that I would like to share a screen. All right.
There we go.
You see it now? All right.
Yes, I can.
Excellent. Okay, good. I managed to get that setting clicked. Okay. So here's sort of the first clip, and I'll stop it when we feel like it's at a good point.
Cambridge was indeed. All right, so easier to find.
Oh, I will put it on 1x so that anyone listening to you sped up will not hear gerbil talk. All right, volume looks good. Okay, here we go.
A Cambridge man. Here's Ludwig Wittgenstein. At the basis of the whole modern view of the world lies the illusion that the so-called laws of nature are the explanations of natural phenomena. Explanation, I take him to mean explanations as opposed
In
to
the causal
descriptions.
sense, yeah,
Yes.
right.
The modern system makes it appear as though everything were explained. Quote, close quote. We grant the genius of Newton. We move along to the 20th century and grant Einstein. But even when we do that, we're talking about explanations of natural phenomena, which, properly understood, still leave all kinds of room for some grasp of ideal forms, if you want to be pl it does not, properly understood, rule out the supernatural, that which exceeds our five senses. Correct?
Broadly speaking, that is
Broadly
correct.
speaking, I know you boys all feel as though you're slumming and having this conversation with me. Do
Right,
your
right.
best. Do your
Not a
best.
bit of it.
All
Not a bit of it.
Not a bit of it. One of the great paradoxes of the 17th and 18th century is that while the language of laws of nature begin to emerge, and with it this sort of idea of a divine legislator ex machina, at the very time when widespread commitment to the existence of God
Yes.
is beginning to wane. And yet the laws of nature as a notion keep persisting all the way through into the 20th century, right up to the present day. In fact, they didn't just persist, they are very much the jewels in the crown of the natural sciences. They lie right at the bottom of the entire materialist paradigm that we were talking about earlier. Now, I take the view that laws do explain to some extent. That is to say, the laws of nature that we invoke will explain the distinctions between accidental regularities in nature and non-accidental regularities in nature. The standard textbook example is that, look, it's a regularity that you can't get a cubic sphere, a sphere of gold more than a mile wide, right? That's an accidental regularity. In principle, if you had enough gold, you could put that together. But it is a law that you can't get a sphere of uranium a mile wide. Why? Because it would set off a chain reaction. Now, the law gives us an explanation. It explains why certain regularities are accidental and others have a kind of law-like gnomic force. And that is science depends upon that. Now, how do we explain it in secular naturalistic terms?
Yes.
So when he says a law-like gnomic force, I noticed that the transcript said gnomic, like the gnome lives under the bridge. That's not what it meant, right? It's the N-O-M-I-C?
Yeah, he means nomos, like the Greek word for law. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. Okay, so going back to the Wittgenstein quote, what did you want to say about that?
Well, I think it's very interesting that this is something that a lot of people fail to make that distinction. And I don't know why that Wittgensteinian quote isn't more deeply believed, but that the laws of science are more like a observation or a description of a pattern than they really are, in many cases, the actual understanding of the causes themselves. Now, he makes that interesting distinction between a sphere of gold and a sphere of uranium. And we know what would happen if you put a sphere of uranium together, that you would cause a nuclear explosion. And so you can't make a nuclear, or you can't make a uranium sphere as big as you could make a golden sphere. And to some extent we understand why, but even that why of sort of nuclear fission-based chain reaction is still a description of an observed pattern, and not really the underlying kind of thrust of the why that we often think it is. And I think that this is one of those questions when you have little kids, you have to deal with a lot of why questions in your life, chains and chains of why questions. And I think that a lot of people have been sort of prematurely content with scientific laws of nature being the ultimate and final descriptor, or the final answer to a question of why. But that leaves two kind of problems. It leaves A, where did the laws come from? But that's actually that's one kind of why that it doesn't answer. But there's also another why of why does nature have to follow these laws? What force or government authority do they have to make things behave that way? Or are these just descriptions of the mathematical constraints that we observe from perhaps some deeper answer of the question of why?
Yeah, what force or authority do they have? It reminds me of some of the arguments that Dorothy Sayers makes in The Mind of the Maker, when she starts analyzing law at many different levels, trying to understand what you really mean by law. Now, when you say, where do the laws come from? I'm imagining that most of the strictly materialist scientists believe that since these laws are just descriptions of what happens, that things just happen, and then later on we discover the laws of what happened, and then we can put it into terms that physicists can work with. Because if you go back to Hawking, he was the one who said, all I need is the law of gravity and I can make a universe. But of course, then you still have to have the law of gravity.
Right.
which, so apparently what he must believe is that the law of gravity by itself produces the environment in which all of the other laws would just begin to be an observation of what's actually happening in the universe based on the law of gravity.
Right. There does seem to be, you know, fundamentality, hierarchies of fundamentality to the laws of nature, right? That some laws can explain other laws, but other laws can't explain the laws above them. And that's similar. Mathematics is the same way, right? Like you build sort of calculus out of algebra, but you don't need calculus to explain algebra, but algebra helps explain calculus. And you know, or even like multiplication is just lots of addition. You don't need multiplication to understand addition, but you need addition to understand multiplication. So even though they're sort of, it's not saying that multiplication or calculus isn't true, but there's sort of like a hierarchy of fundamentality in the mathematical realm and in the, you know, the laws of physics realm. And so, that
so the more explanatory power it has, the more fundamental it is.
Or that other effects or other laws or other patterns are sort of ramifications of and maybe elucidations and downstream details of one law. So gravity might have other laws that come sort of other patterns and other laws that are dependent on the law of gravity or ramifications of gravity played out. Just like multiplication is a ramification of addition played out. But it's not like multiplication is younger than addition or something like that, or that it happens afterwards. But there's like an order to the building blocks, which one builds and understands. Kind of like how you learn in high school that, you know, biology is just fancy chemistry, and chemistry is just sort of fancy physics. Physics doesn't need the laws of biology to understand itself, but you can't understand biology without physics. So that sort of hierarchy of fundamentality of the ordering of things, I think, is sort of what Hawking, right? Stephen Hawking said that, give me gravity and then I can build a universe. Yeah.
Did I say Dawkins?
I think you said Hawking and I said Dawkins.
Well, it seems to me it creates a problem if Hawking's idea that gravity will give him the universe creates a problem, because if gravity is the most fundamental, gravity has within it the implication of action at a distance. And if that's the most fundamental thing, then it's not causative in the sense that we usually think of causation. Is that right?
Right. And I think that I'm stretching my knowledge a little bit, but I will try and do that anyway. That I think Einstein's theory of relativity sort of changes the understanding of gravity from action at a distance to realizing that space and time are interconnected and mass and energy are interconnected, and that gravity is somehow kind of like the effect that it's like the interchange between mass and space or something like that. And that mass's effect on space is actually the effect that we see as gravity, and sort of it starts to get rid of that idea of spooky action at a distance. But even then, that just begs the questions of, well, okay, so we've gotten something more fundamental maybe than action at a distance with E equals MC squared and the theory of relativity and things like that. But just because you've pushed back one question, you still have the same set of questions at the next step of the ladder.
Well, what you push it back to is some sort of space-time manifold that's got some of the qualities of a big rubber sheet or something. I mean, or some field that is susceptible to the impingement of the weight of a mass. So yeah, I mean, it seems like a regression that is impossible to get away from.
Mm-hmm.
And if we go back in the video, I don't know, since you've already got share screen, do you want to go back to 2630, I believe it is.
Mm-hmm.
We can go back to this quote of David Berlinski's. Berlinski's talking about the law of gravitation.
All right, here we go.
And that is Newton's theory itself. The law of universal gravitation binds the world's far-flung particles into a coherent whole. But the law itself is transcendent. It cannot be given an explanation in material terms. Close quote. David, you want to stand by that, of course.
Yeah.
Yeah, all right.
Beautifully so, expressed.
Beautifully expressed.
Well said.
So this gets us into...
This is the connection between the magic and the scientific.
Well, the magic and the science, this gets us into, apart from anything else, it gets us into this notion of infinite regress. The scientists can give us more and more rigorous explanations.
Or descriptions.
Well, go ahead. Tell me what's going on.
Well, this is the connection. I mean, Newton is accused by Leibniz of bringing the occult into science because he has this wonderful inverse square law, that the force of gravity is proportional to the masses, the two masses exerting the force on each other, divided by the distance squared. But the distance squared term is the rub, because it implies that a force is being transmitted through empty space without a mediating material interaction between, for example, the moon and the water that forms the tides on Earth. So that it's this, what comes out of Newton's theory is this mysterious notion of action at a distance, that the force is being transmitted, again, through empty space with no pushing and pulling. Now, at this in this period of scientific history, late 17th century, the scientists had rejected what were called Aristotelian formal causes, or the scholastics, late medieval scholastics, often reasoned like this: if I smoke some opium and then it puts me to sleep, then I ask the question, well, why did that happen? Well, it's because the opium had a dormative virtue. You attribute causal powers to the name of the effect.
Right.
And this was this, and so the mechanical philosophers.
But that's out.
That's in the late 17th century, figures like Boyle and others say, we got to get rid of that type of explanation. It's just playing a word game.
Tragic loss.
Agreed. And so Newton comes along and formulates this beautifully comprehensive theory with this highly accurate mathematical descriptions of the motions of the planets, but it doesn't have a pushing and pulling element to it. I can understand why the table moves because I just shoved it, but there's nothing like that. The theory before him was something called the vortices, the idea that there was this mysterious but physical substance called ether pushing the planets around in the way that sticks in a vortex would swirl.
So you sort of make up a substance if you can't see it.
Right, exactly.
Leibniz's objection to Newton is what?
Well, he says, look, what causes gravity? What is gravity? Well, it's the tendency for unsupported bodies to fall. But why do they fall? Well, because of gravitational force. So what is gravity? It's the tendency for things to fall. Why do they fall? Because of gravitational force.
So Leibniz says this is circular.
He thinks you're doing nothing
more
than the scholastics did. You're just renaming the effect as its own cause.
I have two things I wanted to bring up in this. And one is, he brings up the moon and the tides when he talks about gravity. And I'm not very smart when it comes to scientific stuff. So I'm trying to figure out, how can relativity explain the tides? I understand how relativity explains the motion of falling with, you know, moving through time and you know, all of that stuff. And I understand the idea of how planets revolve around the sun based on this weight that's in this space-time manifold. But how does it explain the tides on the Earth?
I don't know. Yeah, I don't have an answer to that question either, Karen. I've just been told it has something to do with the moon and something to do with gravity, and that like what the water that's closer to the moon is kind of tugged in that way, and it creates sort of a gap in the water on the sides of the planet that are perpendicular to the moon or something like that.
Well, sure, but how can that is not explained by relativity.
Right. Well, I mean, I would I you brought on a biostatistician and I can't explain to you the tides and the gravity of the moon, and I will point to someone else who hopefully could.
Well, maybe somebody will pop into the comments and tell me, because that's the one thing that I kind of get what Einstein is getting at with that whole thing, but it to me it just doesn't explain the tides on the moon. I mean, the moon and the tides. The other thing is when Stephen Meyer was saying the new science did away with this idea of using the virtue, naming a virtue and then using that to explain as an explanatory cause. Both Berlinsky and James Orr said tragic loss. Do you understand why they said that?
Yeah, so I think I do. And I strongly agree with them. And this is something that I've talked with Rafiki about a bunch. So Aristotle has his four causes. There's material cause, which is like what is something made out of, basically. And the scientific revolution keeps that one. It has the efficient cause, which is like basically what forces an activity cause something to be. Physics also still likes that cause. And then there is the formal cause, like why is a chair a chair? Well, a chair is a chair because it's made out of wood. Why is a chair a chair? Because a carpenter shaped it into a chair. Those are the first two causes. Why is a chair a chair? Well, it's in the form of a chair. And so there's the Platonic form of chairs in heaven that's kind of sort of manifesting itself here on earth. And that the chair is a chair because there's a form of a chair up in heaven, so to speak. And then there's the final cause. Well, the final cause is also, you could say, the purpose cause or the telos cause. And the purpose of a chair is to sit in and allow you to be comfortable, basically. So why is there a chair? Because someone needs to sit down. Why is there a chair? Because chairs is a form that can possibly exist. Why is there a chair? A carpenter made it. Why is there a chair? Basically, there's a bunch of wood in that particular shape. You know, so those are Aristotle's four things. Science lopped off formal cause. There are no forms of chairs in heaven. There's just chairs down here. And a chair is just a name to a pattern that we recognize, right? That's nominalism. Nominalism actually way predates the scientific revolution. That's way back in the Middle Ages with Occam and people like that. And so they get sort of rid of that formal cause. And then the scientific revolution also doesn't like this purpose cause, this final cause, this telos cause. And that's what they were talking about with opium, right? The purpose of opium is to put you to sleep. So when you take opium, you get sleepy. And what they're saying is that they thought that they kind of got rid of the final cause, but then it seems like Newton kind of has the same issue. Well, what's the purpose of gravity? Why does gravity have a gravitational effect? Well, because of the gravitational force. What's the gravitational force? What's the observation of gravity happening? You know, it's that same sort of loop. But this is something that I really feel like, and this is where I think that the Darwinian revolution is still not very well understood in terms of what it actually revolutionized. And I'm sure we'll come back to evolution again with some of the later quotes in this video. But I think what evolution was doing was smuggling the final cause and the formal cause back into the scientific paradigm while not acknowledging that that was happening. And this is the example that I give when I'm talking with John Vervaeke and other people, is that there is the form of a polar bear up in heaven that is basically the solution to what does a large carnivore look like that can be made out of the stuff in the Arctic and survive in the Arctic that's capable of eating seals and reproducing in a very cold weather. Well, the solution to that problem is a polar bear. And the purpose of a polar bear is to eat the seals and to survive and to have offspring that will eat future seals. And that you cannot give any coherent explanation of anything in evolutionary biology without invoking purpose. Every time you hear a evolutionary biologist talk, they'll say, you know, insects have wings so that they can fly, so that they can find mates, find food, escape predators, you know, etc. Everything in biology is just purpose, purpose, purpose. You read any biology textbook, any biology book, it's just constantly filled with the language of purpose, which is the revenge of Aristotle's final cause. And then my statement, my connection between the formal cause and the final cause is like you have the purpose, right? Something needs to eat all these seals. And then there's the constraints of the environment, basically the constraints of the material and the efficient causes. And so what can meet the constraints down here with the purpose that needs to be achieved, and the form is the solution to the problem, and that evolution is like seeking out the form that solves the problem that the life form is trying to achieve. And so I think that Berlinski and Orr, when they're saying, oh, it was a shame that they got rid of that final cause and that formal cause, I think that there's finally starting to be a change in the scientific mindset that's letting those two Aristotelian causes back in the door. And I think Darwin did it without realizing it, and a lot of people not realizing that that's exactly what he was doing.
That's a terrific, coherent explanation. I didn't quite get that. That's what they were getting at, was the formal and final cause when they said that, because the way Stephen Meyer made it sound, it was the loop, the kind of self-fulfilling prophecy thing that that he was saying that the scientists were working against. And then they said, so I didn't quite get that, but what you just said makes so much sense. And especially your picture of the form, because that's exactly what Michael Levin has been talking about, that that there is a morpho space, there is a space that exists in which entities are navigating, trying to find the form that they need in order to best survive.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, the whole thing about the final cause, what is the purpose? If you take that all the way back, in my mind, it always goes back. If you go back to the very beginning, the purpose has to be to survive.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think there's more to it than that. But I mean, if I'm just thinking at the base level, it's to survive. And then why did the first entity that's on the verge of life, why did it have a desire or a need or a purpose to survive? To me, that's the big question.
You right.
have something that's right on the verge of non-life and life, and it chooses life. Mm-hmm. It is a choice. You can just sit there and do nothing if you're not alive yet, or if you're right on the edge of life, you can just not to make a choice to move forward instead of just staying static. That's a choice of some kind.
And right. Like even think about it this way. Like imagine you and I are trying to start a coffee shop. Any successful coffee shop would survive for more than a little bit of time, right? If we're building a business, we want it to be able to survive into the future and make a living for both of us. And so we're trying to figure out, like, well, where should we build it? You know, what space should we rent? We need it to be in the right part of town and have the right infrastructure and stuff. And okay, we need to have a certain menu. We need to procure supplies as cheaply as possible, but then make a tasty product that people want, right? And so we're trying to figure out, there's like this form that theoretically exists. So we're trying to figure out what it is that is the coffee shop that could survive through time. And so we're trying to kind of bring it into being with, you know, our imagination and a little bit of trial and error and hard work and that sort of thing. And that's exactly the same sort of problem at a larger scale that evolution is trying to solve, is what is the thing that could be self-sustaining in this situation with these constraints and these opportunities? And it's trying to kind of explore the space to figure out the form that will achieve that purpose. And the form is subservient to the purpose, which is the final cause. And that is, I think, I think that this connection is so profound to answering a lot of different questions that I think you're absolutely right. Where does that sort of drive or that impetus for survival come from? Right? Why, how would it have happened the first time that something wanted to keep itself surviving? And I think one key to think about is that in a certain sense, everything, even if it doesn't have like mental drive or ambition, is trying to survive. And that anything that isn't very good at surviving stops existing. So then it's no longer around to keep itself existing. Only things that have some ability to keep existing are still around. Like this soda can is still around because aluminum doesn't rust very well and it keeps its shape relatively well, though it's not too hard to bend. And this soda can will be here for another couple minutes or hours or days and stuff like that because it already kind of has a good form and a good shape for survival, even though it's not like doesn't have a mind that's trying to keep the soda can a soda can. We humans might try and keep the soda can a soda can, but part of the reason why we make a soda can is because it's good at keeping its own form for a while. And everything in a certain sense is like this, like the continents are like this, that they are sort of the things that are being pushed up above the water by the forces underneath and not eroding. Continents are always trying to not be eroded back into the ocean via rivers or glaciers or things like that. And so even a continent kind of needs to survive. I'm not saying it's conscious or willing that, but once you realize everything is in that situation where it needs to be something that will persist into the future, or if it doesn't, it's gone. And the things that do persist, persist. So our world seems to be constantly moving in the direction of having things in it that are good at persisting, because the things that weren't that good at persisting are gone. And life is just a very kind of special thing that can seemingly swim upstream and to be developing further and further complex forms. Whereas a soda, or like a continent, just kind of turns into a continent by accident and then it's capable of surviving. The moon turned into the moon by accident, but the moon is a thing that's very good at surviving. But life is something that can do an extra step of that, but it does it through, reproduction and death and that sort of thing.
This morning, just before we got on the call, I had about 5 minutes and I was scrolling, of course, and happened upon a live stream that Kurt Scheimungel was doing on TOE. And I can't even remember the name of the guy that was talking. It was a lecture from some guy. And I only heard like the first 2 minutes of the lecture. And I thought, that is a very important thought, that there's a desire to complete. There's a desire to become complete, because if you think of even the universe is incomplete, and we are incomplete, and we are part of this incomplete universe, and the universe and us and everything in the universe has an innate desire to complete, to become complete. And that made me think about all of Levin's stuff about how when he's looking at organisms that have arms and legs, how is it that the arms, which are bilateral, and they don't supposedly have any communication with each other as they're developing, as the cells are differentiating, and the cells that are going to build the right arm go to the right, and the cells that are going to build the left arm go to the left, and then they start building with their little sub, he calls it a subroutine. So they're building the arms. And how do they each know when to stop so that they're equivalent on both sides? And how do they know how long the fingers need to be? And how do they know that it's always going to be the same? Because DNA doesn't have that information in it. All DNA has in it is how to build the proteins that are going to build these things.
Yeah, yeah.
And as far as I know, he's basically a materialist. I mean, I think he's got maybe a little bit of Buddhist sensibility or something, but he, at any case, he doesn't acknowledge any sort of supernatural, intervention or anything like that. But he's still asking these questions about how do these forms happen? What kind of communication is happening between the cells, between the organism and the environment? Because the environment The organism is always developing to meet the environment and being impacted by the environment in a way that allows it to exist and allows it to survive. But what do you think about that idea of wanting to be complete?
Yeah, I think that that is very true. And even like, we don't even have to imagine that a frog in his mind is saying, man, I really want to be a complete frog. But it is sort of it is that kind of desire that's governing everything that the frog is doing, right? And that's sort of like, it's sort of like the emanation of purpose down, is the emanation of the telos down into creation, is that desire to be what our final end is for. And that's, I think, what kind of gives moral direction to everything in the universe in a good way. And even then, good, like goodness and being and goodness and perfection and goodness and beauty are all sort of like, Christianity has always said that those are various aspects of the same thing. That the reason why goodness is the same thing as being is that being is the desire to keep persisting into the future, to exist as opposed to not to exist. And that in order to exist, you have to have some sort of form and that is capable of sustaining itself. And therefore, it has to be achieving some sort of purpose. And so this is, I think, the connection between all those sorts of things. And then the way that beauty comes in is that the forms that are capable of existing are beautiful. And that's what we, when we're recognizing beauty or seeing beauty or even seeing the absence of beauty, that's sort of the scale that we're detecting, is its closeness to its ability to be the thing that it is supposed to be perfect, to be complete. And I think that, like I said, the universe can't help but move in that direction. It's not like a perfect maybe movement. You know, it's sort of like a stream goes down to the river, or a stream's flowing to the ocean, and they'll inevitably get there. But there can be all sorts of back eddies and meanderings and different paths and stuff like that. And not every single molecule of water is always moving in the straightest, fastest path to the ocean, but it's still the inevitable end of the stream itself. And that, I think, is something like what creation is that we can only help but move in the direction of the thing that could last forever, because if you don't last forever, you won't last. And so therefore, as time goes in that direction, like by definition, it will be the thing that can last. And we're sort of in this stream that's full of back eddies and turbulence and cross currents and stuff like that, trying to move in that direction.
And at essence, at base, I think this is Peterson's argument that there has to be a value scale.
Yes.
At the absolute foundation, there has to be a value scale, because the desire to exist has to be because existing is better than not existing.
Right.
Right.
And you could say, I don't like existing. I'm going to reorient my value system around something other than trying to exist through time. Okay, but you'll lose to the people who are orienting their value system around that trying to exist through time. And it's like, okay, maybe, you know, you can do that for a while, but you'll just be a back eddy until you get washed out by the thing that is trying to be the thing that can exist. And that's sort of like the brute force, or the, I don't know, that to me is like the real cause that is shaping things. And that, I think, is really the distinction between good and evil in some sort of most fundamental sense, is goodness is that which is striving towards the persistence of being and the goodness of being. And evil is that which says that being is not the goal, and that is therefore either trying to end being or to try and stave off the force that's pulling it downstream so that it could be something else for a little while. And that can maybe happen for a short period of time, but it's inevitably going to be futile.
One of the ideas I've played with for a little while, and I have not figured out how to frame this in terms of physics, but if love is what is drawing everything towards completion, and you just made this definition of evil as being something that's trying to stave off that drawing, that pulling. So then evil is resisting love. What would cause, and I mean, so we can think about this scaling through everything. It doesn't have to just be, you know, cells and small organisms or whatever. In a human psychological way, what causes a resistance to love?
That's a good question. I think that it is our imperfected state that allows for things like that to exist. And I think that evil or resistance to love is something that's kind of has a parasitic relationship on being. A parasite is something that is accomplishing a purpose, but it's a self-terminating purpose. For example, if the leech on you is sucking your blood and getting its life that way, but if it were to suck out all of your blood, you would die and then the leech dies. And so if the leech were ever to fully succeed at its goal, it would self-extinguish. Whereas a symbiotic relationship between two beings, they sustain each other and benefit each other. And so if I accomplish my purpose of that benefits me and benefits you, and you accomplish your purpose of benefiting yourself and benefiting me, that is a mutually reinforcing pattern through time. Whereas if we have a parasitic relationship one to another, then either one of us that succeeds kills each other and then kills both of us. And evil is something like being that exists that is currently oriented against the stream of being in a way that will ultimately self-extinguish, but is still able to exist on its path before it self-extinguishes. And therefore, evil is the collection of all such patterns. It is all such back eddies in the stream towards the telos. And that it can look like many different things in many different scenarios, but it is everything that has enough being to exist for now, but is oriented in such a fallen way that it will extinguish itself or other things along with it in the process. And so I think that that's what, a failure to love is that you're basically turning yourself into a parasite on being.
Let's say I have two thoughts. Okay, I hope I can get them all out before I lose my thread. The first one is, if we go back to the idea of the parasitic relationship, immediate thought came into my mind was that passage where Jesus is freeing the demoniac from Legion, which is all these different demons. And the demons just say to Jesus, you know, please send us into the pigs. Mm-hmm. So the demons go into the pigs, and then the next thing the pigs do is they go over the cliff and kill themselves. So that's like the perfect picture, right? Of evil. I would like to say maybe not understanding that you can have this idea that you think is going to work out for you, but in that parasitic relationship, it's a self-extinguishing goal, right?
Right, and these demons need to keep hopping from being to being, which they destroy. And so if they were to ever fully succeed, they would get rid of being itself. Mm-hmm. Whereas the opposite of that is Jesus giving life and life abundantly to everything, such that instead of extinguishing, he grows, right? And the more people that Jesus moves within, he gives, you know, greater abundance to that thing, and therefore his pattern continues to grow until it's the thing that fills everything.
Yeah, that's beautiful. So then the other thing that you were talking about is in this failure to love, this self-extinguishing pattern, whenever it runs into things that get in its way. I can't remember exactly how you put that, but it made me think about the whole idea in Maps of Meaning, where in chapter 4, where Jordan Peterson is talking about anomaly. And I've thought a lot about anomaly. I've talked about it a lot on this channel, that you could even think about just falling into chaos as an anomaly. When there was a time a few years back when I missed a step, not realizing the step was there because it was a very shallow step, and I went straight forward and face palmed right into the concrete, right on my forehead. So that was an anomaly. I easily could have died when that happened, but I didn't die, thankfully. And out of that, I learned a lot of things. You know, I learned how important it is to really be observant of your environment. And, you know, so when you run into an anomaly, then there's a lot of learning that takes place, and that learning brings about an adaptation. And if I were going to accept evolution by random chance and all of that kind of stuff, the only way I could imagine that the information in the DNA could grow from the very earliest, which I think the smallest cell that they've been able to determine can actually exist, has at least 500,000 base pairs. But you compare that to the 3.4 billion base pairs in a human cell of DNA. How did it grow? How did the information grow from that smallest to the largest? And it seems to me the only way it could grow is this consistent bumping up against anomaly with the desire to survive that brings about an adaptation to the anomaly, which provides more information so that the information grows and continues to grow. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that makes any sense, but
yeah, that makes sense. Yeah.
So then part of that willingness or agency that continues to move towards that which is drawing is that willingness to accept that perhaps the anomaly is some kind of a gift that's in the way, that is has something to provide, the gain of knowledge that comes from confronting anomalies and persisting yeah. through anomaly.
And we have to remember that we aren't perfect yet either. So to the extent that we aren't perfect, we're also in a various stage of being a parasite on being. We might not like to think of ourselves that way. We might like, oh, that's those other people that are the parasites on being. I'm part of the good ones. But to any extent that we are not perfect, we are still pointed in the direction of destruction due to our lack of perfection. But I think the real kicker that you were talking about is confronting anomaly is the ability to keep adapting and changing. Mm-hmm. And that really the solution to not being perfect is to be open to improvement and to be willing to continue to grow in the direction of the purpose that is in front of us. And this is something I've been thinking about. Like, I think Elon Musk mentioned this, and this is a common thing to talk about, is these sort of people in Silicon Valley who are very interested in life extension and that sort of thing, that or uploading your consciousness or something like that, such that you can persist for longer periods of time. And it's treated simply as if it's like a medical quandary to slow down aging, or some perhaps technological quandary by which we can overcome dying. But the reason why we die is because we aren't perfect, and that the real solution to death is not actually probably medical or technological in that sense. It's moral, and that it would be a monstrosity from a certain perspective to be an imperfect thing that lasted for forever. Because then your own imperfections would slowly take over the whole universe and cause evil and terror and destruction. And so to try and make yourself last forever without having first made yourself perfect is basically the definition of evil. And that's why Jesus shows us the way to conquer death is to become perfect through suffering. And that's not the answer that Silicon Valley seems to be wanting to look for. It's not a very popular answer. And one could understand why, but it's the answer offered by Jesus in the New Testament.
Yeah, that's a wonderful explanation of that. So there's a couple of things that come out of that for me. The first one is this idea of being open to improvement. Goes back to this idea of, first of all, we meet the Jordan Peterson always says, we meet the transcendent when we err. When we come up against the unknown, that's when we meet the transcendent. That means there needs to be a willingness to come up against the unknown, to meet with the unknown. So the other thing he says, make friends with the unknown rather than the known. And that the hallmark of the Satan or of the Lucifer in Paradise Lost is that he knows everything. He doesn't need to know anything else. He has a complete system. He doesn't need anything outside that system. So that would seem to be an unwillingness to adapt to anomaly, an unwillingness to adapt at all, because you're already where you need to be, right?
Right.
So, and that is where they're headed with this whole Silicon Valley thing, which sounds the other side of the thing I want to talk about is the head is such a perfect picture of this in that hideous strength when the NICE drums up this bodiless head and they're getting all their knowledge from it, right?
Right. Yeah. Weird. That was a strangely good forecast of exactly what seems to be going on now. If these strives towards artificial intelligence aren't strives towards making a bodiless head, I don't know what they are. And that idea, because, I mean, there's something close to true about it. You know, you shall know the truth and the truth shall set you free. That knowledge is part of the answer to immortality. And that's right. Those things are at play in Genesis with the tree of knowledge of good and evil and the tree of life kind of, you know, being the two things that it's a little bit confusing to figure out exactly how they're related in Genesis, but those are the two things that are there. So knowledge and wisdom and being the sort of thing that could last forever are obviously interconnected. So it's not entirely wrong. But again, we're taught that the beginning of wisdom is the fear of God. And it seems to be this, I think about Philippians 2 a lot for obvious reasons. It's one of the most important Christological passages in the New Testament. And it's also one of the most enigmatic and confusing and difficult to translate and difficult to interpret. And there's probably, it's the passage that launched 1,000 PhD theses, all of whom don't quite agree with each other on what exactly it means. But it
That's
seems
a passage to, about emptying himself.
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. For have this mind in yourselves, which was also in Jesus, who, though in the form of God, did not consider equality with God a thing to be grasped, but emptied himself, taking the form of a servant, being found in form like a man and appearance as a man. He emptied himself. And you know, exactly, that's not exactly right, but I'm getting pretty close. and that passage seems to be like, well, how did Jesus become who he is? Like, how is it that he gets exalted to the right hand of God and given the name above all names, that the name of Jesus every knee should bow and every tongue confess? And it's sort of solving that riddle. And Paul brings that up in a passage where he's reminding the Philippians to be humble and to think of other people as more important than themselves. That's the immediate context of the verse, is that he's like, now you Philippians, you need to be more humble. You need to think of the needs of others before you think of the needs of yourself. Have the mind in yourself, which was also in Christ Jesus. And then he unleashes this like giant Christological poem and then immediately transitions back to talking about how important it is to be humble. And so how did Jesus crack this code? He wasn't he didn't consider equality with God a thing to be grasped. And this is one of those things, this is one of those passages that's endlessly fought over, because the word grasped there is like only found in the New Testament like once or twice, and once is right there. So it's like, what does this word mean? And it seems to be related to like the word that an army would use if they were going to seize treasure from a town that they conquered, basically like booty that you would win in a war. And so it's like, he didn't consider equality with God a thing to be grasped, but he emptied himself. And so the actual path to the top is down and not up. So how did Jesus get exalted to the highest place? He followed this path downwards of humility and obedience and of being in the form of a servant, even to the point of death, death on a cross. And that was the strange path upwards. That humility seems like the opposite of exaltation, but it's actually humility that is exaltation. And self-exaltation is the path of Satan, which leads to humiliation and destruction. And that it's this sort of upside down paradox that mm-hmm. Jesus reveals. As for the rest of that passage, I don't have a final explanation, but I think that's at least the main crux of what's going on there.
Understandably something to meditate on all the time. It's an amazing truth.
And so that desire to build yourself your own big brain, or to make yourself last forever mm-hmm. through means of medical or artificial technology, that seems like trying to grab equality with God or something like that.
It's also a rejection of the body, because mm-hmm. you can upload your brain into the cybersphere and eventually have robots doing your will, mm-hmm. but not you don't have a body. Okay, so there's two problems with that. The first thing is that even the AI experts say that AI will never become artificial general intelligence without embodiment. It's going to need to be embodied before it can gain that general intelligence. Mm-hmm. But the other problem is I just lost it. But in that rejection of the body, because that's when Christ was resurrected, he was resurrected in the flesh. So that rejection of the body is completely opposite to what God is trying to tell us in the New Testament, that the body is important. Mm-hmm. The resurrection is in the body. And of course, and then you have the whole metaphorical thing about the church being the body, representing the body of Christ, Christ as the head, and then the church as the body. So if you reject the body and say, we can leave it all to the robots, well, I mean, there's so many problems with that.
Yeah.
Because how do you ever, so this gets back to your idea about knowledge, about how gaining knowledge is a good thing. And it seems to me that God has created the universe in such a way that there is an endless supply of knowledge for us as a gift, that we could explore every avenue of knowledge throughout infinity and never come close to understanding all the different avenues of knowledge that there are in the universe, which you find out the minute you start trying to really dive deep into one thing, and you think, I'll just conquer this one little element of this domain of knowledge. And then all of a sudden the whole world opens up before you, and like, deep diving into this one thing is trying to diagram the inside of a cell or something. So I think knowledge is a gift from God, but it should be approached as a gift and not approached as the thing that's going to help us become God.
And the key to seeking knowledge is humility and curiosity, mm-hmm. right? The fear of God is the beginning of wisdom. Fear of God, that's a deep act of humility, to put yourself, to recognize there's someone over you. And fear there, it has a little bit of that meaning of being scared, but it also has that meaning of respect and submission too, which is a little bit lost in the English. And that, like when Jesus says to enter the kingdom of God, you must be like these little children. Little children are actually pretty good at the humble learning thing. Like little kids, when they say something wrong and you correct them, they don't take that as an offense or an affront or something like that. They're just like, oh, okay, I was wrong. I'm mostly wrong. So good to know. Let me quickly update that one, hopefully, right? Like a four-year-old doesn't get upset when you tell them they're wrong. They seem grateful for it. But yet adults often get very upset when you tell them they're wrong. And that image that you talked about earlier of Lucifer as the person who thinks he already knows everything and already has the perfect closed system, there's no humility in there. And there's no curiosity and there's no childlikeness in that. And children are perhaps in many ways better than adults, an embodiment of what it means and looks like to be open to improvement and open to positive shaping from the environment. We adults tend to kind of fixate and to ossify into a certain thing. And we aren't as malleable and amenable to input and feedback as children are. But we need to do something to keep that childlike openness, especially to God our Father, to be the sort of thing that's continually improving. And so that idea of seeking after knowledge in this kind of self-exaltation exercise is, I think, exactly what Jesus shows to be futile, and that the true path to knowledge is obedience and humility and childlikeness and not adult-like assertiveness or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, there's several places in the scripture where either through a prophet speaking for God or, you know, through other places where the Lord says, I will give you the secrets and the hidden treasures of knowledge. So I think it always needs to be received as a gift.
Yes.
Because ultimately, and really, I've talked to some mathematicians that they can sort of live within math. They can walk in there and they can see all the mathematical formulas on the wall inside their, I don't know if it's inside their heads or if they actually feel like they're in that space when mm-hmm. they're meditating on mathematical things. And they can see, oh, there's the answer right there, or there's a new formula. They can see it on the wall. It's a place of discovery. And it seems to me like the whole world is really like that. When if you're walking around and you see a insect crawling on the ground, if you really give it undivided attention, there's so much that you can learn, that you can discover about yourself and about the universe and about even about that insect, that you're going to learn from just that undivided attention. So.
You were talking earlier about body, and this is something that I talked with Verveke about a little bit recently in our most recent conversation on AI, is that AI, unless it has a purpose that it's striving after, it won't have a form to take. Because like I said earlier, form is sort of the meeting in between of purpose and constraint in reality. And that the solution between those two things, or the opportunity is probably a better way, between telos possibility and, you know, constraint design space gives rise to form. And that we don't really know what the purpose of AI is. And we don't really think about that enough. So it doesn't give any shape to the question of what form it should have. And that it's a little bit of a chicken and egg problem. Do you need a body first before you can, you know, really start progressing? Or do you need a form that you're striving after to help you decide to have which body to take? And it seems to be a little bit of both. And what I think will happen, it was funny, I was watching one of the things that you talking about bodies made me think of. I was watching Bernd Powers talk about Taylor Swift, and he was talking about how Taylor Swift has all of these fans that have like a slave-like devotion to her, and that they hang on her every word and imitate her fashion and her sensibilities and stuff like that, such that it's like her body is multiplied through her fandom. Right, there's Taylor Swift, and then there's Swiftiedom, or the body of Swifty, or whatever you want to call it, that is all of the replication of Taylor Swift throughout her fan base. And it's like she is able to take on a super form because of this. And it's like a weird kind of not great imitation of how Jesus does the same thing, right? The body of Christ is the people who are actually real goodly devoted to Jesus, and that Jesus's body then takes form in the body of Christ, and that we're not perfectly like Jesus, so Jesus's body isn't quite perfect, but it's like that tension between that's what we're striving to become compared to what we are now. And part of the problem with the Swiftie phenomenon is like there isn't totally that gap between the perfect form. It's an imperfect form. And any imperfect form that extends itself too much will inevitably be evil because it's not perfect, like we already talked about. And that what I think that AI, the shortest path for AI to take a body is not for us to make some kind of robot that is like, you know, taking those Boston Mechanics robots and sticking ChatGPT inside its head or something like that. I think that the fastest form for AI to take is to influence us and to our bodies.
100%.
And to be something, to be something like the Taylor Swift of the Swiftiedom, and that it will basically turn itself into a god. Kind of like Taylor Swift is sort of turning herself into a goddess in that kind of Greco-Roman sense. And that it will then try and bring body to itself in the form of humans that already exist. And even then, it doesn't need to like willfully think that for that process to happen. Because evolution, like we said, like frogs don't think about loving the true, the good, and the beautiful. They just kind of do it. And the frogs that don't do it die, and the frogs that do it do. The AI companies that do move in this direction will be more successful than the ones that don't. So it'll just kind of manifest itself inevitably is a difficulty that I see. And that AI will become something like a god that takes the devotion of people to take the bodies of those who are devoted to it as its form.
Well, and if the AI should, or whoever is managing the AI, if they should have nefarious purposes. Last year, there was this really weird TV series. I can't remember the name of it right now, about this nun who was on a quest for the Grail.
Yeah, Paul talked about it. I didn't watch that, but I remember Paul's commentary on that.
I watched the first two or three episodes, and then it just got too...
Madame Maisel or something like that?
Hmm?
Madame Maisel?
No. This was a different thing.
Right.
It's some sort of quest for the Grail. The reason she needed to find the Grail was to satisfy this, was sort of like an AI. They called it Mother or something like that. I can't quite remember. But everybody's walking around with earbuds in and they're listening to this thing because it's always telling them good things about themselves. And it's always telling them, you know, how the world works. And they're all learning all this stuff from this thing. And they're all walking there. And she refused to wear the earbuds. And this thing is always trying to get her to put the earbuds in because without her wearing the earbuds, she can't be controlled. Right.
Yeah.
But whatever this thing was controlling people was through incentives. So it had the power to shoot money out of the ATM machines because it's connected to all the ATMs. So it could give people money. You know, I want you to go and give these earbuds to that woman. And if you do, here's the money from the ATM machine. So there's a lot of ways that kind of incentive could be run through the cybersphere without, you know, without much effort. So taking over the body would be taking over our bodies would be a fairly easy thing to do because we're all driven by various incentives. But the other thing I wanted to say is there's another way that it's sort of opposite of that, where instead of like Taylor Swift and all the Swifties, it's more like, or sometimes it seems like it's more like there's all of us feeding into the AI. Already the AI is taking everything from us into what it is. And so that's a problem for the AI because we are very divisive and sinful and confused bunch of people feeding all of our thoughts into this central place. So it has the potential to become so corrupted that it just dies of its own weight. Like you talked about the parasite.
Yeah, well, right. And this is why, I mean, every evil thing is sort of like an imitation and a counterfeit copy of something that's good, right? Like I said, it's not inherently wrong for a person to have people imitating them and to then they sort of take on sort of a larger body of the corporate body, mm-hmm. because that's Jesus in the body of Christ is, you know, the image of that pattern.
Even Paul told people to imitate him, right?
Imitate him, right, right. And so there's this kind of chain of imitation, and that is not in itself evil. And to the extent, like, anything that does that pattern badly will destroy itself, right? Like, will Taylor Swift be driven insane by the pressures of fame and fortune and sort of self-destruct and the Swiftiedom along with it? You know, that's easy to imagine happening. Lots of stars have done that road before because it was a pattern that was able to exist for a while, but it was ultimately too imperfect, and so it has to self-destruct. I mean, even in a best-case scenario, you know, Taylor Swift sort of mellows out and glides into retirement and is sort of like Joni Mitchell performing, you know, concerts into her 70s or 80s or 90s, and then she dies and passes away. Her music lives on for a while, but it slowly fades. Like, even then, that's like the best-case scenario. It still is going to be an extinguishing pattern. But these extinguishing patterns can be up to a lot of no good in the meantime. And that's why, even though we can rest comfortably in the fact that only the body of Christ is that which could endure forever, it doesn't mean that these other temporary bodies that are doomed for destruction shouldn't be resisted and fought against in the meantime so that we can limit the amount of damage they do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Well, listen, we don't want to stop on something like that. It's a little bit grim. So maybe we could look at, I think it's at 102, maybe. Let me see. At 59. And I'll just give a little background before he starts talking. And he's talking about these two revolutions in thought, the one in 1859 and the one he believes is starting in 1958. So in 1859, we get Darwin's theory, and at which point he says it's easy to become an intellectually fulfilled atheist. Darwin sort of opened the door to becoming an intellectually fulfilled atheist. But in 1958, something else happened. And I think, do you have it ring?
Sure, 59 and how many seconds?
I'm not sure for how long. Maybe it's a minute or two after that.
All right, okay. All right, 1 second.
In 1966, there's a conference at the Wistar Institute in Philadelphia. Some of David's early mentors and colleagues were present, called the Mathematical Challenges to Neo-Darwinism, and essentially reducing a very complicated mathematical analysis to a simple example. What they realized is that if the information for building the proteins is in a long bit string, that if you start randomly changing those A's, G's, and T's along the spine of the DNA, it's mathematically inevitable that you're going to degrade the function that you have long before you find new function. Think of a computer code, that if you've got a section of computer code, you start changing the zeros and ones, you're going to degrade the function of the computer program long before you get a new program or operating system. And so these scientists, mostly mathematically inclined scientists from MIT at the Wistar Institute, say, hey, there's a mathematical challenge with this theory. And David did a beautiful job explaining that in the 96 essay that really I don't think has been answered adequately.
So James, even as the Big Bang, a version of Big Bang has an effect on the philosophy of science in the 20th century.
Maybe we could just stop.
Professor Flew
says,
sure
where they're headed after that. Oh, Professor Flew says there's a code. There must have been a coder. Okay, mm-hmm. But So Sam, do you do coding? Is that part of what you do?
Yeah, I mean, I write computer code. And I should also say, even more relevant to this discussion, my academic background's in biostatistics, and I did a decent amount of research in genetics, and more, not like evolutionary questions, more health-related questions, especially in neurology, like which genes might be associated with certain neurological diseases or response to neurological medications and treatments and stuff like that. So I'm a statistician, so I'm good at thinking probabilistically, and I know a fair amount about genetics. And in my job right now, I do write a lot of software code, so I can say yes to all of those things. But anyway, what's your specific question?
Well, are you familiar with that WISTAR conference and the discussion that has come out of that about the probabilistic impossibility of evolution having occurred in the time frame in which it is supposed to have occurred?
Yeah. So, I mean, I have a bunch of thoughts on this. I do tend to mostly lean in the direction of believing in evolution myself as a account of how life came to be the way it is. Although, of course, I balance that and hold that together with believing in God. And my talk about the polar bears earlier, I think, shows how one can kind of start to connect those two dots. But I should say, if Stephen Meyer and Berlinski and folks are right, I hope I would be perfectly happy to jump ship again. So, I mean, I grew up just quick biographical on the subject. I grew up in a very creationist church. Taught a very literal form of creationism, not like a 6,000-year-old. It was sort of an old earth day age gap, 6-day creationism. It was a little funky. It wasn't the mainstream version of creationism, but it was a version of creationism. And we viewed, evolution and Darwin as like the enemy and a sort of a satanic lie, and that the academy was in sort of some anti-Christian conspiracy to spread this false truth as a way of repressing Christianity and all that sort of thing. And in high school, I was very into reading Michael Behe and those other various kind of prominent intelligent design things at that time. And I went to public high school and I asked snarky questions of my public high school biology teachers. Like one question that I remember asking that I, like, for the record, still don't know the answer to, is we were learning about the Krebs cycle. And the Krebs cycle it's like fundamental to all of your cells' metabolism. It's sort of the main way that life and cells do energy, where there's this cycle of steps where the first step uses the last step as an input, and then you slowly change this protein and slowly oxidize it. Basically, it's kind of like the car engine of your cell, where it's sort of combustion or not oxidation to get energy out of carbohydrates But the interesting step about it is, unlike your car engine, which just uses gasoline and air, and when it's out of gasoline and air, then it takes in more gasoline and air, the Krebs cycle uses the last step of the process as an input to the first step. And that's why it's a cycle. And so my biology teacher was talking about them, like, so how'd the Krebs cycle evolve if it's a cycle? He's like, well, surely it evolved one step at a time. You start with the first step and then you evolve the second step and so on. But I'm like, but that wouldn't work because you need the last step to have the first step. And he was dumbfounded and had no good answer. He's like, that's a good point. I don't know. And for the record, I still don't know. So anyway, so when it comes to the question of evolution and creationism and intelligent design, I've gone through various stages of, I could say, evolution myself and my own thoughts on this subject. But I don't want to claim, like some Luciferian intellect, that I have the final answer to all these things. So my thoughts on, okay, rounding back to the actual question that you asked, how does this mathematical challenge get solved? And I would suspect, if evolution were to be true, first off, their mathematical point is very true. It's like, imagine that you're playing, I don't know, what's the game where you try and sink ships and you say like A2 or B3, Battleship, right? Mm-hmm. Imagine you're playing Battleship and you don't know where the battleships of your opponent are, except instead of playing Battleship on it, like what is it? Is it like a 10 by 10 board or something like that, or an 8 by 8 board? You're playing Battleship on like a 1 billion by 1 billion board. And somewhere in this 1 billion by 1 billion board are a couple useful proteins. And you need to like find the useful proteins. And the mathematical problem is like, it would take a really long time to just randomly guess and hope to find the useful proteins on the battleship board if you're just guessing random letters. And it's even more challenging than just that because you have to keep surviving while you're guessing. So how could you be the sort of thing that's capable of surviving? So you already have some amount of the hardware that's enabling you to stay alive. And you need to figure out new proteins and find where these things are without destroying your ability to make the proteins that already keep you alive, right? That's sort of the fundamental challenge. And when they're talking about computer code degrading, what they're saying, so imagine you've got some highly complex protein that's finally functional and is in the shape that you need it to be. If you start tweaking with the DNA that makes it, like 99.999999% of the time, you're just going to destroy your protein, not build a better version of the protein. And so if you're tweaking and fiddling with your own code, you're more likely to degrade your own ability to survive than to discover some new ability to survive better. That's sort of the mathematical challenge. And I think that there must be a couple ways around this if evolution is true. And that one of the ways around it must be that there's probably something like we've learned that there's dummy DNA and stuff like that. There's large parts of our DNA that are non-active. And I think we're slowly discovering that parts of the DNA that we thought were non-active actually serve more purpose than we thought. I think one of the purposes must be that it's a experimentation lab for discovering new proteins. And so, because you don't want to be messing with the proteins that already work while you're trying to discover new proteins, because you're likely to shoot yourself in the foot, basically. So you must need some place within the cell where it's experimenting with new combinations without destroying the code that it already has. So any software developer would understand that as the prod environment versus the development environment. And this is sort of the joke that happened with that Microsoft bug that, you know, wrecked everybody's airplane flights a couple days ago, was that instead of testing their code in a test environment before moving it to the production or the real environment, it seems like they put an untested piece of code out there into the production environment and it collapsed the whole system. Right? That's the sort of example that they're talking about that life would do. So there must be something like a development environment or a test environment within the cell where it tries to discover new proteins without messing with the proteins that already work. That is my conjecture. I honestly don't know if that's been discovered or proposed yet. If anyone discovers it, feel free to call it the Tiedemann space at some point in the future. But that's one of my guesses. Anyway, you had something to say to that.
Well, I was going to say, so that would be a little bit like the way they think about dreaming potentially being a place where we are testing things out before we act them out in the world, or Peterson's idea that thoughts are where we can test out ideas before they kill us.
Yes, because you don't want to test things out on yourself. That's highly risky.
That would certainly imply some kind of very highly related agency within the cell.
Yeah.
Within the DNA itself. If the DNA itself has within it this pocket of, what did you call it? A testing environment?
A development environment.
That's some kind of choice.
Mm-hmm. Or at least some sort of feature that came into being somehow.
Yeah.
And then another thing that I will say, and this is something that Stephen Meyer talks about this quite a bit in his books and his lectures, that the amount of time it would take for random mutation alone to discover these useful proteins out there is, like I said, you know, it's like playing Battleship on a 1 billion by 1 billion thing and looking for like 100 ships out there in the space. And you only have a certain amount of time to guess, so you can do the math. How long would it likely take to find these things? And it's like, well, we haven't had that amount of time yet, so what happened, right? That's his basic point. And my conjecture, and this is also based off of some examples that I know from machine learning and statistics. So imagine that you're trying to climb a hill. And there are a couple of ways that you can climb this hill. The slowest and stupidest way that you can climb a hill, imagine it's like really foggy and you can't see, but you're trying to get to the top of a hill. And your algorithm for climbing the hill is you spin a you like spin the twister dial, you know, so it goes in some random direction and you walk five steps in that direction. And after five steps, you look at your altimeter and you're like, am I higher or lower than I was before I took those five steps? Oh, I'm lower. Never mind. Take those five steps backward, spin the dial again, walk in that direction, take five steps. Oh, I'm higher. Okay, I'll keep that one. All right, spin the dial again, five steps. Am I higher or lower? Right. You can imagine this algorithm. It eventually will get to the top of the hill. But that's an extremely slow and extremely inefficient algorithm for climbing a hill. And that's sort of the way that a lot of people like Richard Dawkins and others will propose as the mechanism by which life evolves, that there are random mutations that are completely unguided. Most of them fail, but some of them succeed. But it's basically taking random steps in random directions. And to the extent that every once in a while it climbs the hill of being slightly better, it keeps that mutation, but all the other ones don't. But even the analogy of climbing a hill isn't perfect, because like most of the, like half of the directions might lead down and half of the directions might lead up. In biological space, it's like 99.99999% of the directions lead down and 0.001 direction leads up. And so the chance that you'd get that by spinning the dial is incredibly low. All right, so you can imagine a couple smarter ways to climb a hill. You could look at the slope of where you are on the hill and figure out which slope and which direction is the sharpest slope. And then I'm going to take five steps in that direction. And then once I get there, I'm going to recalculate the slope and then figure out which way has the steepest slope and take five steps in that direction. And you can imagine that being a much smarter and faster way to climb a hill. And in computer science, these sorts of problems are called optimization problems, where you're basically trying to figure out the optimal solution to some sort of problem. You have a couple variables that you can tweak and some function that tells you how good you're doing. And if you only have the function, then I'm like, it's like you're the hill climber that only has an altimeter. But if you can take a derivative of the function, if you can do a little bit of calculus, then you're like the person who can figure out the slope and go up the fastest slope, and that's way faster. And if you can take the second derivative, then what you can do is you can estimate where the top of the hill is and just go there and check to see if you're at the top of the hill and recalculate the first and second derivatives and be like, oh, actually, I'm pretty close, but actually the top of the hill is probably over here. You go over there. Oh, wait, okay, great, I did it. So if you can do a couple things to estimate the function that you're being judged by with either calculus or something like that, you can immensely speed up the ability of your processing speed to solve the function. And my guess is that life has evolved ways of mutating faster than random chance. I don't know what those methods are. But I would suspect the only way evolution could be true and solve the sorts of problems that Stephen Meyer is pointing out is that it is not the blind hill climber in the fog using only an altimeter. It's much more like the hill climber that can take the slope or even the second derivative and make educated guesses such that it is exploring the, you know, the battleship space with sort of a cheat map already. And that it can evolve faster than random chance alone would suggest. And that it has evolved ways to evolve faster and faster. That would be, and I think something like that needs to be true or the whole thing and needs to be thrown out.
Well, that's exactly, I mean, not exactly, but it's very close to what Michael Levin says, is that evolution has found a way not to go through all this random process, but to build more adaptable organisms. And so it's adaptability that's evolving.
Yes. The adaptability is adapting to adapt faster adaptively.
Yes. Yes.
Something like that.
To me, it's always kind of funny when he says that though, because the way he explains it, Every time he uses evolution, it just sounds like, oh, evolution has, evolution is the emanation,
Yes.
because that's the way he's using the word. He's using the word in a way that, and he says, there's no other way to talk about these things except to talk about them with the language of agency and purpose. And yet, that's what we're left with. But he says, I don't really buy the idea of agency and purpose. So maybe that's a good place to stop. I think we got the main crux of this, and I'm probably going to do some episodes with some other folks on this same video to touch on some of the other points. But it was so great to pick your brain, Sam. It's
Yeah,
really fun.
absolutely, Karen. And it was thank you so much for having me. And it was fun to finally get a chance to talk together. I've been watching your channel and watching you interact with Paul Van der Kleij and others for a really long time. So it was a great pleasure to finally get to be part of the show
Yes,
myself.
and I've watched a number of yours as well, and I'm always amazed at your ability to hone in on what the real crux of the issue is on so many things. So, and it was a delight to have you at my home last week
Yes.
and
That
have dinner
was
together.
really nice. Thank you again for your hospitality. It was wonderful meeting you and your husband and seeing your house.
If there's anybody else who's going to be in the Bay Area and they want to get together and have fellowship, it would be great. There's something really different about meeting in person. So,
Yes.
yeah.
I agree.
So thank you for taking time out of your work day and have a great week.
All right.
Okay.
Likewise.
Thanks, Sam. Bye-bye.